the Boston Book Festival. You not only show your support by being here, but by your generous donations and by your interest in reading, celebrating words, authors, books, and the arts. My heartfelt thanks to Debbie Porter. I don't know if she's here, but she's my friend and the founder of the Boston Book Festival. And our city is certainly a richer place for it. I wasn't prepared to tell you about the Vespa, but I was asked to tell you about the Vespa. You all have to rush out after this event and buy $10 raffle tickets to win this Vespa. And they have to be purchased today, your raffle tickets, and all of the proceeds will go to the Boston Book Festival. So even if you don't want the Vespa, I urge you to buy the ticket. Now I would like to turn the program over to Sarah Lewis, Professor of the History of Art and Architecture and African American Studies, Harvard University, and Sebastian Smee, critic, art critic for the Boston Globe.
Thank you, everyone, so much, and thank you, Cindy, and to you and husband John for sponsoring this event. Very grateful. I wanted to thank as well, obviously, the Boston Book Festival and Deborah Porter for all the amazing work that she does, and Harvard Bookstore as well. Above all, I wanted to thank Sarah for being here and for being willing to be on stage with me. I really feel, as I said to her, it should be the other way around right now. But she's been incredibly busy, and it's incredibly kind of her to be willing to be here. Again, thank you all for coming. I want to apologize slightly in advance. I feel, living here and writing for the Boston Globe, I've been testing the patience of local audiences slightly, talking about my book. And so in the interest of not repeating myself and knowing that I would be on stage with Sarah and knowing what she's written about, I've chosen to talk about something a little broader than the specific subjects of my book. It will all come back to those subjects, as I think you'll see, but most of it's a little more abstract. And above all, there won't be any images, so I feel... that's a bit of a bummer, but we can always put the Vespa back up there if you like. I feel bad that it was advertised as an illustrated talk. But anyway, I wanted to begin with a well-known quote. There really is no such thing as art. There are only artists. Many of you may recognize it. It's from the introduction to E.H. Gombrich's The Story of Art, which I think is one of the biggest selling books on art of all time. The line is famous, but its renown is ironic, since no one today seems to place so much too much faith in the idea behind it. We live, as the Picasso scholar Anne Baldessari has pointed out, in an anti-romantic, hygienist era, which rejects the genesis of works, preferring instead to focus on the outward manifestation of works. More and more, as I've heard Sarah say, you know, we sanitize the business of creativity when we talk about it. Gombrich, I think, appears to have come at things differently. Elaborating on his idea, he began by emphasizing the first part of his statement. Art with a capital A, he wrote, and I quote, has no existence. It's merely a shorthand way of describing a whole range of activities, from taking colored earth and roughing out the forms of a bison on the wall of a cave, to designing posters for hoardings. And of course, this is the part of Gombrich's statement we can easily agree with. In fact, today the definition of art has swollen to encompass almost every area of human activity, from cooking and accounting to having someone shoot you with a gun. Most forms of human product, by the way, I'm talking about an actual work by Chris Burden where he asked a friend to shoot him with a gun in a gallery, if that seems strange. Most forms of of human product, including human waste product, have a good chance of being displayed in our public art galleries if the right people can be found to boost them. Art with a capital A is decidedly out. Myself, I have no problem with any of this. In fact, I'm grateful for the sense of liberty, and expanded possibility, both conceptually and in terms of medium, that so many artists feel today. Imagine if contemporary art was still limited to the old traditional media. There'd be no Christian Markwe, whose work The Clock is on show at the moment at the Museum of Fine Arts. There'd be no Sheila Hicks, no Janet Eckelman, no Matthew Barney, no Tara Donovan. The list is endless. We would be impoverished, I think. It's really the second part of Gombrich's statement, "There are only artists," that warrants closer examination. What did he mean? Actually, we're almost 20 pages into his introduction before we find out. "What we call works of art," he writes, "are not the result of some mysterious activity, but objects made by humans for human beings. Let us also remember," he continued, "that every one of their features is the result of a decision by the artist, that he may have pondered over them and changed them many times, that he may have wondered whether to leave that tree in the background or to paint it over again, that he may have been pleased by a lucky stroke of his brush which gave a sudden unexpected brilliance to a sunlit cloud, and that he put in these figures reluctantly at the insistence of a buyer." That's the end of the quote. The wording, of course, sounds a little old-fashioned, and so perhaps do the examples, but the gist is clear. Art is just an abstraction. It doesn't really exist, but artists do. They think and they make. It seems obvious, really, and yet today many of us in the art world have trouble coping with this idea, embroiled in what we like to call the discourse around art. Many of us bury the gnarly business of actually being an artist beneath a blanket of skepticism, envy, and ideological suspicion. We seem to prefer to look away from the mess that creativity so often entails, not just literally in the studio, but psychologically, morally, intellectually, unless it's to criticize, to advertise our own moral superiority. We, and I'm generalizing wildly here, of course, show our sophistication by reminding each other that the idea of artistic genius is, when all is said and done, a myth. Echoing long-standing academic positions, we tell ourselves that art operates at a crucial remove from the artist. And indeed, it does. But the notion that being an artist might require hanging about in a studio for years on end, thinking, observing, studying, practicing, failing, as Sarah writes in her wonderful book, The Rise, making thousands of tiny decisions, conscious and unconscious, harnessing accidents, wondering what to do next. Well, the less said about all this, the better. I think it's been like this for a while, ever since structuralist and post-structuralist critiques came to the fore in the humanities departments of universities. These critiques had many wonderful and intelligent things to say about the reception of art. Gombrich himself had written that great works of art, and I'm quoting again here, seem to look different every time one stands before them. They seem to be as inexhaustible and unpredictable as real human beings. The structuralists and their successors wanted to account for this amazing changeability, I think, to bring some rigor to our understanding of why great artworks behaved like this. "Myths have no authors," wrote Claude Lévi-Strauss, and the new academics wanted to treat works of art and literature precisely as myths, I think. In doing so, they insisted on taking the work of art almost as something found, like a clue at the scene of a crime or an archaeological treasure, to be unearthed and deciphered, rather than as the masterpiece of a particular artist who lived a particular life. Most importantly, they wanted to analyze and understand the contexts in which artworks were received and judgments made, all in an effort to see them with fresh eyes, to acknowledge their true complexity. The birth of the reader is ransomed by the death of the author, as the wonderful critic Roland Barthes so famously wrote. And very often artworks were and continued to be enriched by this approach, especially in the hands of people as brilliant as Barthes. Often, however, I believe, they were impoverished. Certainly, any idea of the artist as an autonomous being with individual agency was given fairly short shrift. The artist's intentions and biography were all either ignored or treated with deep-seated suspicion. When they weren't ignored, they were subjected to preordained theoretical treatments. Psychoanalysis, for instance, gave a theoretical structure to the hunch that the gap between intention and result can often be so wide that it made little sense to treat the artist as a coherent, conscious agent in what she created. So psychoanalysis, despite its gradual falling from favor in other areas of life, became a kind of default mode in discussions of art, a way of finding depths that were structural rather than personal and idiosyncratic. Marxism, too, was interpreted in ways that marginalized the artist, making him or her the accidental product of deterministic forces. It made more sense to study those forces, wrote the Marxists, than to immerse oneself in the sentimental fiction of the singular, intentional creator. A consequence of the new criticism was that art making lost its special, honored status and became just one more activity in the whole production of culture. This, of course, was a boon to critics and theorists since it elevated their own status. And just as increasing numbers of theorists saw themselves functioning on the same level as artists, more and more artists saw themselves occupying territory that once had been taken up by the critics and theorists. Artists started referring to their practice, a more intellectual, professional-sounding word than work. And their physical productions were increasingly accompanied by lots and lots of words. Many of the ideas which fed into structuralist and post-structuralist understandings of art have themselves been critiqued, but as critiques and theories have risen up and retreated like waves collapsing on a beach, the role of the artist has continued, I think, to be sidelined and de-emphasized, if not in the popular imagination, which still loves the romance of artistic genius, then certainly in the universities and the art press. Those who presume to make it their job to write or talk about art are often embarrassed by the messiness of artistic creation. And indeed, there is a great deal about making art, as Sarah has showed, that's not only messy in the literal sense, but clumsy, humdrum, awkward, and lacking in profundity. But because it is hard for those who write about art to know what to say about these aspects of the process, they ignore them or try to clean them up. And then, of course, there is the embarrassing matter of artists themselves. It seems to me that one of the reasons we're so keen today to puncture the myth of the individual creative genius is that we do not wish to think too hard about what's actually involved in being an artist. We're humbled, threatened, and mystified by it all at once. And so we patronize and snigger at the stereotype, bearded Matisse behind his spectacles with his pigeon and his scissors. What a dear old sweet man. Barrel-chested Picasso in his Y-fronts. The priapic egotist. As for those poor deluded beings who cut off their ears or commit suicide or turn to alcohol or drugs or suffer nervous breakdowns, God knows that the list's endless. Well, it's all a shame, but if one really must turn oneself into a cliche, so be it. That's the feeling I think that a lot of people have. Many years ago, John Updike wrote that if fiction is in decline today, it's because individuals no longer have the courage to set forth and suffer the consequences of their dreams. Now, whether or not fiction is in decline, and whether or not this is the reason, is not really the point. The point is that being an artist really does, I think, involve setting out and suffering the consequences of one's dreams. The consequences, it scarcely needs pointing out, are often unpleasant, even if not in a life-threatening way. And they can be unpleasant not just for artists, but for the people around them. In a description of just one fairly common variant of what can go wrong, the narrator in Glenway Westcott's brilliant novella, The Pilgrim Hawk, says, and I'm quoting here, "No one warned me that I really did not have talent enough. Therefore, my hope of becoming a very good artist turned bitter, hot, and nerve-wracking. And it would get worse as I grew older. The unsuccessful artist," and here Westcott's drawing an analogy with the actual hawk that's the subject of his book, "the unsuccessful artist ends in an apathy, too proud and vexed, waiting upon withheld information, bored to death." That's the unsuccessful artist. But there's a flip side, of course, which is that successful creativity often results from a state of mind that is wholly enviable, a sense of being on a roll, operating according to a new set of rules, according to instinct rather than custom. enjoying an expanded license. Shy writers who lead quiet family lives may feel this rush as much as rock stars or extroverted stage actors. The rest of us are fascinated by this state of being, and I think very often jealous. We sense too, I think, that artistic freedom is subversive, and that the license artists grant themselves is potentially socially destructive. And we're probably right. All of which provides more reasons to mock artists, to pull them back to earth, or to tame them in the academy. It's true that some successful artists are responsible members of families and of their society, even paragons of virtue. But many of them are not. And that may be in part, I think, because choosing to be an artist involves putting oneself on the line in a way that the rest of us often have trouble understanding. Whether or not an artist feels she had a choice in the matter, the cost is very often great. What the artist creates in imagination, and this is a quote from Stefan Zweig in an essay on Casanova, what the artist creates in imagination is, as a rule, what he is debarred from actually living. Whether or not that's true, what is true, I think, is that the tension between interior creative life and exterior so-called normal life is a great source of conflict in any real artist's life. It can take great willpower, great selfishness, or great sacrifice to resolve that conflict. And any resolution is unlikely to be lasting. And yet, of course, almost everything in society today militates against interior life. We are more rushed, more social and communicative, less reticent about matters that once stayed private, and more forcibly subjected to the standardizing forces of the media and the market than ever. More people than ever today claim to be artists, but it may be, I don't know, that fewer experience deeply the tension between their inner imaginings and their outer life. Many artists today are models of sanity and sobriety. They speak eloquently about their work. They have tremendous CVs. One can only be impressed. But sometimes, just sometimes, one finds oneself wondering if anything genuinely interesting is going on behind that sturdy, reliable, sympathetic facade. As I wrote my book, The Art of Rivalry, I often found myself so embarrassed by the various melodramas in the lives of the artists I was writing about that I was reluctant to go on. Did Degas really have to be so prickly, so patronizing to women? Did Picasso really have to be so promiscuous, such a bohemian cliche? Did Freud and Bacon really need to get so carried away with gambling, with consorting with criminals and leading such preposterously complicated love lives? And did de Kooning really need to start a relationship with Ruth Kligman, the sole survivor of the crash that killed his rival, Jackson Pollock, less than 1 year after the crash? To their mutual friends, that news, as I wrote in the book, was the equivalent of a dream that upon waking seems so nakedly available to interpretation that it embarrasses the dreamer into silence. A lot about the lives of these artists was that way. But they were the artists, and I'm not. I don't for a second feel the need to, the urge to defend them morally. A lot of their behavior is morally indefensible. But I'm not a moral arbiter either, I'm an art critic. And in a sense, I wonder, what can I know of what was involved, what it truly put oneself, what it truly took to put oneself on the line in that way? What freedom felt like as well after so much struggle and doubt? I tried to imagine, and as I did, I became fascinated about what I could learn about certain key relationships between artists. How important was Matisse to Picasso during a particular period of time when both were making breakthroughs? What did de Kooning's support and his constant challenging presence mean to Pollock? What did Bacon mean to Freud, and what did Manet mean to Degas? And in each case, vice versa. What I discovered was a pattern of yielding and resistance, of friendship, intensification, breakthrough, and then very often a kicking away that was sometimes explosive. And then, in the end, regret. Lots and lots of regret. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, I know I am not alone in feeling honored to be able to hear you describe your work. The book, The Art of Rivalry, is, for me, was a detonation, and also a book that let me understand why, when the Pulitzer Prize awarded you the award for criticism, they stated, it was for your vivid and exuberant writing about art, often bringing great works to life with love and appreciation.
Thank you, Sarah.
There's a level of just, indeed. So I want to do as little speaking as possible so that you can speak more about this incredible book. And I thought I would begin by asking you about your decision to write about this sort of what you might call the prime unit of innovation and creativity, the pair, the creative pair.
Right. No, it did seem to me that, as you say, it is such a great engine of creativity. I was conscious, you know, in writing each of the four chapters in this book, and I didn't even spell that out. One is on Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon. One is on Manet and Degas. Another on Matisse, Picasso, and the final one on de Kooning and Pollock. And I felt very conscious that in sort of focusing in on just these pairs, I was leaving a great deal out. And of course I was. You know, there are sort of creative moments in cultures, aren't there, which involve so much more than just pairs, whole groups of people, and it can get very complex and very juicy, very interesting. There are many great examples, obviously. You know, you think of Bloomsbury, and you think of you know, the Cubist moment, which, you know, Matisse is there for that, but you think of Picasso, not so much with Matisse, but with Braque and with Juan Gris and so on. So I realized I was leaving a lot out. But in focusing on these actual pairs, I really did become conscious that in each case, at least for a given period of time, one particular person seemed to mean the most to the other. And therefore, their relationship became incredibly freighted and incredibly volatile. There was a pattern I observed in each of these where one artist was a little behind the other, both in age, perhaps 5 or 10 years, but also in how far they'd got in their own work, you know, whether they were sort of advancing or stuck. In each case, there was one that was kind of stuck. And, you know, I think Degas, for instance, incredible draftsman, better than Manet at drawing, and very intelligent person, was nonetheless sort of stuck making these pictures of, you know, illustrating episodes from ancient myth or the Bible, and his parents were despairing of whether he'd ever get to finish anything. He then met Manet, and Manet was suddenly on a roll at that point. He'd just submitted a work to the Salon that had everyone buzzing. A group of fellow artists came to visit him at his studio, and sort of pay their respects because they were so impressed by what he'd been doing. And so from that point on, Degas sort of falls under his spell and changes not only the way he works, but his kind of way of living. And I think this was a key thing, that it wasn't just about the work. It was about an influence that was social, that it was emotional, it was in terms of temperament. I think Degas was incredibly impressed by Manet's temperament. And so he starts, you know, frequenting the cafes and turning up at the theater and all these things that, of course, we end up knowing Degas for. Going to the ballet in the theater and going to the cafes. But it's really under Manet's influence and under his spell that he performs this. But then, when I mentioned the word volatile before, I think then this relationship does get very volatile. You have a situation where, you know, one feels oneself falling under the spell of another, but losing a part of oneself, perhaps, in that process. Or one's own identity is threatened. And, you know, that's when a great artist will really sort of push back to some extent and find ways to shore up his or her own identity. And, you know, that's a pattern that I observed throughout. And I was surprised to find that it seemed to repeat itself in various relationships. But it repeated itself in these four relationships, sort of, I felt most strongly, and I guess that's why I chose to write about them.
Yes. Just so that the audience, those audience members who haven't yet read your book can understand the beauty of the prose, when you describe this idea, the nuance of rivalry, this sort of push and pull, at one point you say, you describe it this way, when you fall under the spell of someone, there's often a dual movement within you. Even as you succumb to the other person's powerful influence, you feel an equal and opposite impulse to bolster your own identity, to fortify yourself, in a sense, to push back. This is in the chapter about Manet and Degas in particular, right. And there are other such beautifully lyrical passages. You chose to focus, though, on not, and many have written, right, about creative pairs, not the form of the pair, but the rivalry there.
Right.
What
right.
made you decide to hone in on this?
Well, yeah, it's rivalry is, it's interesting that we settled on that word. I think it in each case, it really was a rivalry, but it was a friendship as well. And it was so what was involved was a kind of a yielding and an openness to it, to that influence. And then, as I said, that dynamic changes. But, you know, rivalry, yeah, it's a fascinating subject, and it's been treated all the way through, obviously, art history. I mean, all the famous rivalries from the Renaissance and beyond. We could list them all. But I felt something different was going on in the modern period. And, of course, I guess, you know, the modern period, one could say, begins midway through the 19th century with Manet and Degas and some of those other artists. And I wondered what it was that was different. I mean, the cliche of the rivalry between Michelangelo and Raphael and Leonardo and Titian and so on really has it very dramatized, and they're kind of enemies slugging it out for supremacy, certainly for commissions. But in the modern era, things are a little different. I think what changes is that there's suddenly this new premium placed on originality, on a kind of wild originality. And there are many explanations for why that begins to happen at this point. But it creates an interesting situation, which is that the criteria for artistic excellence are no longer objective. There's no sort of, you know, artistic greatness used to be a question of mastering and extending a tradition. But suddenly it becomes about stepping outside that tradition completely. And when you do that, how can you then tell? What criteria do you use to judge whether what you are doing or not is any good? Those criteria simply aren't there anymore. The critics aren't on board. They're laughing at you. The public's laughing at you. And don't forget, I mean, Manet, Matisse, these people experienced this to an incredible degree. I mean, Manet, the battering that he got through the 1860s was just unbelievable, humiliating, and so discouraging. And he was pretty tough, I think. But by the end of that decade, I think he was really vulnerable and beaten down. Matisse as well. We know the stories, if we've read Hilary Sperling's wonderful biography of Matisse. He suffered anxiety attacks, you know, random nosebleeds, insomnia, you know, had to go on walks. I mean, we think of Matisse as this wonderful painter of indolence and luxury and sensuality, but, you know, he went through hell in a way. The pressures were extreme, and I think it was often because he didn't himself know whether what he'd done was any good. There was one situation, he was down in the south of France, he'd done a painting of a local boy, a sort of postman or a young postman, and then he did a second version where he really distorted the forms of the boy. The first was, you know, radical enough. It was fairly flat colouring and brushy brushstrokes and bright colour, but it was more in line with what he'd been doing. Then when he did the second version, it was really quite distorted and wild and looked crude. He sent it back to Leo Stein, who, along with Gertrude and Sarah and Michael Stein, was one of the first people to show interest in what he was doing. And he said that this wasn't his own painting. It was by a postman. Because he... it seems that he did this because he was so frightened that he would have turned them off, his own work. And Another story of him sending works to the Russian collector, Shukin, in Moscow. Shukin opening the box with the latest productions of Matisse, which were, as I said, incredibly wild at this point. And Shukin really wanted to love Matisse, and he had bought quite a few of his things, and he was persuaded. Matisse was a very forceful, you know, apologist for his own work, I think. And the story is of Shukin opening this box and pulling them all out, leaning them against the wall, looking at them, and weeping, because he couldn't get it. I mean, and he was like, I'm supposed to like these, but oh my God, this is crazy. I can't fathom what's going on here. But he stayed in that room for several hours, and by the end of it, he was convinced that there was merit. So anyway, this is a long digression. But simply to say that, you know, these objective criteria, even if you have someone incredibly sympathetic, like Shukin or the Steins, what you've done can be absolutely bewildering, and to yourself as well. And so I think it's in that situation that a fellow artist who is sympathetic to you, who is perhaps influenced by you and revealing that influence in their own work, as Picasso was with Matisse and as Degas was with Manet, can be a tremendous affirmation. Yeah. And I think Manet felt so heartened that someone as brilliant as talented as Degas was being openly influenced by him. And that was almost affirmation enough for him to continue. And so that, in a sense, is what made this idea of rivalry as much about that kind of intimacy, that susceptibility, that yielding, as about the more cliched idea of sort of, you know, rivals butting heads. That was my feeling anyway.
There are so many questions I want to ask. I'm just trying to hone in what's really core, because I'm sure there'll be great questions from the audience too. And one of them, it occurs to me, it's to do with process. I think one of the opportunities we have here is to discuss your process for creating what I really feel is a masterful book. When I was reading it, I realized that in order to access this level of vulnerability in the lives of these artists, you had to undergo a kind of forensics at times, right? To understand what hadn't been said that spoke volumes, right?
Right.
Whether it was Degas having works of Manet or whatever it
right.
was, you know.
Right.
So I wonder about this idea of the reliance of your own research on this sort of forensic approach.
Right. I mean, thank you, Sarah. It's a great question, because, of course, it was also a fair amount of reliance on speculation. And,
yes,
and you know, I tried to, go to all the sources and do as much research as I could to work out what exactly was going on. In the case of these eight artists, they've all been the subjects of terrific biographies by really great writers, and I recommend those biographies to all of you. I certainly know that I was very reliant on them. And of course, in biographies, there's speculation too. In the case of Pollock, a lot of speculation in the biggest and most celebrated biography of whether he was perhaps homosexual or not. These sorts of questions you constantly have to weigh. I've been criticized in some parts for too much speculation, in other parts sort of for not sort of, you know, saying what I really think happened and always sort of having to hedge. But I felt it was important to hedge, to acknowledge uncertainty where one couldn't be certain. There are many areas like that. I mean, in the case of Manet and Degas, we don't really know for sure why this canvas that Degas painted of Manet and his wife, and which he then gave to Manet, Manet later slashed with a knife, cutting through the figure of his wife, it's still a mystery. I've spent so much time thinking about it, and I have a thesis or a hypothesis, if you like, about what was going on. I think it was a number of things building and to a kind of crescendo, which is not a neat answer, but there were quite a few things sort of all building up to create this tension, and I think they help us understand why this might have happened. But what I write is not definitive, and I don't claim that it is in the book. And I try and minimize the, you're right, that forensic thing is terribly important. You need to get beneath the evidence of, I mean, you have to look at the works very carefully, but realize that works can only tell you so much. And then you have to read as much as you can, as I said, about what was going on in the lives and in the milieu of these artists. I found that tremendously exciting. You know, I mean, it's a thrill to think about all these circumstances. What as you've written so well about, what all the circumstances that are behind creativity and all the failures. I mean, perhaps I'd love to hear something from you about that question of failure. I mean, I love that the quote of Thomas Edison about. Would you like to just say it? Because I'm sure you've got the exact wording in your head, but it's so crucial.
And it's central for this idea of the sort of irreplaceable function of the support that comes from a pair overcoming these failures. Thomas Edison, when he was inventing the incandescent light bulb, had his assistant come into the laboratory at one point, just dumbfounded that he could continue. And he said to his assistant, "I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work."
Is that fantastic? I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And, there are so many other great things on failure. The Beckett quote, fail again, fail better.
Exactly.
I mean, it's...
But
it's in those situations that relationships... can start to mean a lot, and a lot more than sometimes art historians have tended to credit, I think, because they can offer a kind of support and so on.
Absolutely. Winston Churchill had this great quote, too, who I didn't realize Freud had knocked out for his anti-Semitic comment.
Not Winston Churchill, but his son.
Well, read and you'll learn this, too. But Winston Churchill said, success is the ability to go from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm.
Right.
And you're describing the way in which that occurs in large part, right?
Right. I mean, it's, it is so interesting. And I think that, as the dynamic in each of these relationships changed from the more intimate and yielding to the more volatile and explosive, I think that, you see... how hard, I mean, you can imagine, I think, how hard it must have been for Matisse, for instance, who was clearly in the ascendancy. He was, in the sense that he was being celebrated as the most interesting, this is after the very difficult period of abuse and so on. But, by people in the know and supporters, it was clearly Matisse who was ahead of Picasso in terms of being celebrated as a fantastically interesting new artist. And then, of course, Picasso starts to overtake him. And really, it was just like that. I mean, he suddenly started getting all the attention. And it must have been incredibly frustrating, I think, to Matisse, who, as I write in the book, I don't think had even acknowledged or registered that he was in a competition with Picasso, who he saw as almost a sort of very brilliant and impressive and likable protege of a kind. My sense is that really was his feeling. And then there's Picasso inventing cubism with Braque and stealing Braque and Derain, who had sort of been in the Fauvist camp, the Matisse camp. Picasso brings them over to his side, and it becomes a kind of almost an all-out war at one point. But as I said, Matisse didn't ever really quite register he was in it, or for a while. And then he said something. When he started to realize what was going on and that he was really losing his cachet, if you like, to Picasso, he gave an interview to Apollinaire, who was very much in Picasso's camp, where he said, "I've never avoided the influence of others. I would have considered it a cowardice and a great lack of integrity within myself if I had done so." And I thought, what an amazingly brave and bold thing to say at that very moment when he's had this enormous influence on Picasso, and then he's seen that sort of, in a way, used. And I think it all sort of focuses on the Demoiselle d'Avignon, that painting of Picasso's. But, he sees Picasso move on to something quite different. In a way that almost seems to be parodying Matisse. And yet, he's big-hearted enough, magnanimous enough, and gracious enough to make that point about never avoiding the influence of others. And I think that's really important. When we think of rivalry as butting heads, we have to remember that it's not. Influence is much more mercurial and complicated than that.
This really gets me around to, I think, what I was hoping we could discuss, which has to do with the stakes of the project, you know, the why of this project, right? Before coming to Harvard as a professor here, I was at one point a critic at Yale School of Art, right? And the term critic is interesting, right? The question is, what does a critic do that's distinct from, say, a professor? But one of the things I gleaned, and it just really relates to the idea about the stakes of this project, is you're trying to discern the gap between an artist's intentions and their effects.
Right.
You know, how far are they away from their goal with their work, right? And that might be a bit of how you approach works when you review them, et cetera. Mm. But part of the gap there, and I think what makes the process so interesting, is it's so interior. It's very difficult to define and describe, and you're able to give us a sense of that interiority. Was that part of your rationale with writing this, to give us this portrait?
Well, I tried to, certainly, Sarah. And yet, you know, it's very true that artworks, once they are made and they're out there in the world, they do have this incredibly objective quality, you know, In my talk, I wasn't at all trying to say otherwise. I was just trying to say, I suppose, that in celebrating that incredibly objective quality, this thing existing out there in the world, that it doesn't really matter what the artist's intentions were. In many senses, it really doesn't. We can nevertheless forget so much of what was sort of juicy and interesting and productive. Right. In the artists and their mode of creativity. I mean, I celebrate this objective quality of art. It's wonderful that you know, we can look at works where we don't even know who the creator was and be incredibly moved. There's this sort of almost imperious objectivity that the great artworks have. And I think that, you know, in the Academy, that is celebrated and rightly so. But it's just been interesting to watch the pendulum sort of swing away, I think, to some extent, from what, you know, from thinking more about artists' intentions to, for a while there at least, certainly when I was at college in the 90s, and I think to some extent the hangover is still there of not wanting to acknowledge artists' intentions at all. That famous phrase of Barthes, the death of the author, is part of that. But he was such a great critic and you know, criticism, I really believe, can bring works of art alive and be an artwork, you know, in itself. I don't think I've ever achieved anything like that. But, you know, Oscar Wilde wrote beautifully about, you know, he wrote an essay, The Critic as Artist. And it's very persuasive. And you really do feel you're in the hands of someone who is deeply artistic in what they do. So, yeah, critic is an interesting word. Yeah. And, of course, it has a very pejorative sound to many people. But I think that... we're all critics in a way, in a really profound way. We're all critics when we take up work, and of course, artists are the most critical of all. If you speak to an artist about some contemporary of theirs, you know they've got it's hilarious often how their own vein of creativity often requires that they dismiss or want no part of many other forms of criticism. Whereas when you're a critic for a newspaper, I feel, you know, you have to be unusually Catholic in the small key, the small C sense, you know, and accept all different modes of creativity. When you're really mining one vein of creativity, which is what great artists do, I think it's understandable that they don't have a lot of time for this kind of art or that kind of art. They're doing this, and that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm fine with the term critic, and we're all grateful that you are our fantastic art critic here at the Globe. When you read the book, you'll find incredible discoveries from the sort of forensics that you do. You made me think about one, the intensity and the energy that comes with the artistic process. You know, you described so beautifully with this quote by Louise Liddell of Lucian Freud. She said, "To be with him in his company is like sticking your finger in an electric socket and being wired up to the national grid for half an hour.
Right.
And Bacon, you said, was not immune to this.
Right. No, I think that's true. I think probably Bacon was a bit like that in his own way as well. They were incredibly... I never met Bacon, but I was lucky to meet Lucian Freud in London. He was already 79 then, but you know, I still feel I'm trying to digest that. What kind of a person he was. I mean, he was an extraordinary presence and absolutely electrifying. And he had this sort of... I always think about what it was like to go up to his front door, knock on the door, and he would open it. He, like a lot of, you know, theatrical... I mean, I'm just thinking of the way he would open the door. He would sort of have his head down in an almost shy kind of way, almost not wanting to meet your eye, almost like an animal. He had a very sort of animal-like presence in many ways. But like a lot of shy people, he had this is what I was trying to say before, he had a real theatricality as well. And then when you would speak with him, you know, his eyes would literally flare with intensity. They were sort of as if they were being held open, very wide, and he'd be incredibly locked into what you were saying. And of course, he was a great raconteur and so on. But of course, he led the most extraordinary life and ridiculous numbers of lovers and 13 children by different partners. And I discovered, you know, in writing about him that you know, early on he'd had relationships with men as well. So it's interesting that when we try and think about the complex lives of these artists. I think they're fascinating in themselves, but thinking about how they relate to creativity is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I know we now have time for questions from the audience.
Yeah, right, sorry.
Yeah.
Talk to them. Any questions, please?
So we have runners with microphones who'll come down.
Do you think that the modern, postmodern, minimalist art has detracted from the personal projection of the artist into the work to the extent that artists have put themselves into a little category of their own self-knowledge where, you know, they have to either have long text to explain what they're doing or that the audience is only artists and not other people? Do you think there's... I noticed the majority of the people you chose are in that revolution before minimalist art and the complete objectification of art in a way. Do you think that's...
Thanks for the question. You want me to answer the question?
Yeah, I was interested because you were studying personalities and the way that the art is projected through
right.
it. So my question is do you feel there's a huge absence in the personality being projected through postmodern art?
Right. So I don't know if you all were able to hear that, but the question was just about whether minimalist and postmodern art was often sort of denying the personality of the artist and so on. And I think absolutely, in ways that I find incredibly interesting. I think minimalism, I mean, we're talking about two big categories there, minimalism and postmodernism. But if I just focus on minimalism, I mean, I think that... you know, there was a great reaction against the sort of blurted self-expressionism of abstract expressionism, for instance, which got its comeuppance fairly quickly with first pop art and then minimalist art and then conceptual art. And I think that reaction made a great deal of sense. You know, the histrionics, if you like, of a lot of abstract expressionism could be very off-putting, and a lot of the heroic rhetoric that went with that, which is often very macho, you know, minimalism was an antidote to that, to speak about it at its, you know, in its sort of most basic way. I think, as well, a lot of those artists were looking back at earlier kinds of art. People like Piero della Francesca, for instance, this wonderful sense of calm and almost in a kind of an aloofness and an autonomy that certain great works of art back in history have had. And minimalism tapped into that spirit and then took it someplace else in a very interesting way. And I'm a huge fan. I mean, every time I go to Mass MoCA and see Sol LeWitt's wall drawings, I want to die. I think they're amazing. But thank you for the question, yeah.
Do we have any others? One right there, yeah.
Hi. I was wondering if you ever thought about writing about when an artist goes from being very academic to having that breakthrough where they become who they are. For instance, Kara Walker or Georgia O'Keeffe. Because I think that would be something really interesting to really dive deep into.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel in a way it's a subject, as a newspaper critic, I write about all the time. Whether it's Georgia O'Keeffe or Frida Kahlo or, Sheila Hicks, I mentioned before, is an artist I really love. Whenever you get to see a retrospective of an artist, almost the key question is, when did it happen? You know, when did that artist become who they became, who we sort of have grown to love them for? It's always interesting. You know, there are always things going on there, both formally in the work, but also in the life. I'm very, very keen to see the Agnes Martin show in New York that's just opened. I've been reading a lot about it. And, you know, it happens in different ways, and sometimes it happens without, you know, one other. We talked about the pair, but without one other person, it happens internally, or it happens, you know, in response to a bigger milieu. But almost always, it's a combination of all those things. But it's always a fascinating subject. Absolutely. Yeah.
Can I just add to that? Just two things. One, Kara Walker speaking November 17th here at the ICA in Boston, which you all might
fantastic.
Enjoy.
She's got a wonderful work up there at the moment as well.
And also, just to do with, well, there's much to be said here, but I want to make sure we have more time for questions. But the question about minimalism and this, I also think are sort of tied. The Agnes Martin show is going to be fantastic. Recently, when I was at LACMA, the director of the museum, Michael Govan, was showing me around the installation there. And I think there's so much that's hidden with minimalism in particular when you don't know the stories behind the generation of these works. There, in Michael Govan's case, it's the pairing between the artist and the curator, deciding how the works are to be hung, how you're meant to experience these objects, you know? And that's, I think you're also being too modest. That's part of the contribution of this project. You know, you're offering what's really invaluable and can't be seen otherwise oftentimes with minimalist work. And you do discuss breakthroughs with Lucian Freud in particular, for example. You trace the moment of breakthrough, right, from something academic to something more public. So he does a lot of that already.
That's what I tried to do anyway. Thank you, Sarah.
Other questions? Yeah. We have the microphone here to the gentleman in the front. We have one up in the back there. Maybe we can get the microphone to him too.
Oh, thank you. Rivalry among critics, especially if you have a book now.
Is there rivalry among critics?
Whether you like it or not. Like.
Right, right. Oh, of course, of course. there are so many critics I love and others I like less. And so, yes, we all read each other, I'm sure. We're part of the sort of diminishing circle of people who do actually read us, probably. But, it's funny. I while I was writing this book, I was thinking a lot about two dear friends of mine here in Boston who are both writers. Jeremy Eichler, my colleague at The Globe, who's a classical music critic, and James Parker, who's another friend. He writes an incredibly brilliant column in The Atlantic. I thought about them because whenever I read their work, I do it with some degree of envy. You know, I really do. And they're both very different writers, too. So that intrigued me, the sense of, you know, I want some of that. I want more of that in my own writing. But it's very different here and here. And who am I in relation to that? And you know, do I want to become more like that? But if so, I also love this. So, you know, I don't think you stop going through those mental motions, you know. No matter how old you are, no matter how long you've been doing it, I feel incredibly privileged to have them as friends, and we get together a lot and talk about writers we like. But it is funny, even in that very friendly relationship, there is a sense of envy, and I think kind of rivalry. You know, often if I'm feeling stuck, I'll go and read something by my friend James Parker or Jeremy, and it'll help me. it'll help generate some kind of energy in me. It's an interesting thing, and I think we all have things like that in our lives, whether you know what we do is creative or completely different.
We have time for one last question. Who shall it be? Should we take a lady in the front?
Yeah, well, yeah. I absolutely.
Yeah.
So I just sorry. Wanted, first of all, I've enjoyed your talk, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just wanted to question whether you think critics aim to create taste.
Do critics aim to create taste? That's
great
really
last question.
Really great question, absolutely. I won't go on, it's a big subject, but I think that that no, I would say, the answer is no, but I would say we feel pleased if we do indeed have any kind of influence on something that's probably, you know, beyond being influenced by critics, the art world. You know, all I'm trying to say is that when you write criticism, in a way you're writing about, you do so because you want the world to come around a little bit to how you see things. I think that's just the truth, you know, and it would be disingenuous to deny that you want to have that kind of an influence or even if it's just very small. You know, that's why one is a critic and that's why, you know, one creates work probably as well, if you're an artist. So I think we do wish to have some kind of influence, but not in a programmatic way. I certainly don't think of, you know, I don't have some big agenda. I mean, and I think in that sense, criticism has changed from the days of, say, Clement Greenberg and Harold Rosenberg, who really did seem to have an agenda of what, you know, where they felt art should go. This sort of, this, you know, narrative of progress through history. It all was very sort of Hegelian and a bit silly, I think, perhaps. Great as they were as writers, you know, I'm working on a much smaller scale and for a newspaper, I don't think in those terms at all, but I think it would be a mistake, even if you had a huge influence on a big readership, to think in those terms in this day and age. But you respond to things specifically, one by one, and you take things on their merits. That's my approach anyway. Anyway, thank you so much for the question, and thank you all. Thank you, Sarah, so much. Thank you.
You should tell them about your signing. Fantastic. Such an extraordinary conversation. I hope you all enjoy speaking with him afterwards at his book signing. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.